You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Connection Between the Living and the Dead, Collected Works, Volume 168, translated by Aria Jackson. 8 lectures held in various cities between February 16th and December 3rd, 1916. This is Lecture 1, entitled Life Between Death and Rebirth, given in Hamburg on February 16th, 1916, and it begins with a preface. During the war years, the following words were spoken by Rudolf Steiner before every lecture that he gave to members of the Anthroposophical Society in the countries affected by the war. My dear friends, we call to mind the guarding spirits of those who are out on the battlefields where war is now raging. Spirits watching over your souls, may thy wings bring our petitioning love to the human beings on earth entrusted to thy care, that united with thy power, our plea may radiate help to the souls whom we seek lovingly to reach. And as we turn to the guarding spirits of those who have, because of these tragic events, already passed through the gate of death, spirits watching over your souls, may thy wings bring our petitioning love to the human beings in the heavenly spheres entrusted to thy care, that united with thy power our plea may radiate help to the souls whom we seek lovingly to reach. And may the spirit whom we have for some years sought to approach through our spiritual science, the spirit who passed through the mystery of Golgotha for the salvation of the earth and for the freedom and advancement of humanity, may he be with thee and thine arduous duties. Lecture 1. Our striving is to cognitively penetrate, as far as possible, the worlds that are closed to the familiar sense-oriented intellectual awareness connected to the physical plane. Indeed, over our years together, we have come to an understanding that human beings, when in the physical body, inhabit a world that is only a small fragment of the entire actual world. But because we meet so seldom, even at these meetings, everything cannot be explained. That is, not everything from the ground up. Other gatherings and writings will reveal that what is spoken of at these meetings, which we are able to hold only rarely, is well founded. Our focus at such meetings should be to become conscious of the important and essential aspects of the actual larger world that encompasses the physical world. Since we last met here, various events have taken place within the circle that cultivates our spiritual science. A large number of dear friends have crossed the threshold of death since the beginning of this difficult time of war. These friends who have passed through the gate of death have directly participated in these major events. This means that we ourselves, within our circle, have also been affected by the great spiritual world, in that these souls who were among us entered the spiritual world when they laid aside their bodies. Part of the way of thinking that emerges from spiritual science is that these souls who have left the physical plane and have been received in another world remain connected to us, as they were connected to us when they still looked at us with physical eyes and could speak to us by means of their physical body. It is precisely when we draw near to the so-called dead in the world, where they exist, that we become aware of all that is soul-shaking there, and that must at some time be released within our soul. Then we attempt to look over the threshold that divides us from the spiritual world, and to enter a world that can be regarded only from the disembodied soul state. You can understand that over the years since we last saw each other, various experiences have passed through my own soul, and out of such experiences words will be spoken and will be considered together here today. Indeed, over the last years I have often discussed with our friends the fact that for those who can see into the conditions of existence, real trust can mature only when they realize that those who were loyal, sympathetic souls here on earth remain so after they have passed through death's gate. For our work, we certainly do not lose those souls who have gained an understanding of our cause through their connection with us here, before passing through the gate of death. There are such loyal colleagues among these souls that although opposition and lack of understanding toward our cause here in the physical world are at times so great and become ever greater, as we have seen, we must still believe in our cause taking its place in the evolution of humanity. We can reach this conviction through the connection with the disembodied souls who have acquired an understanding of the whole meaning of our cause for the evolution of humanity. Indeed, only when we approach with an open mind the world in which the so-called dead exist, we can say it in this way, although the dead are clearly present in the entire spiritual world. Only when we are capable of approaching this world as a visitor, as a companion to the dead in the spiritual world, will we then learn to know more and more what has already been emphasized here. We will learn that the concepts, thoughts, and ideas that we have formed about this world, because we are in physical bodies, must be changed in many ways, must be made pliant, so that they can also encompass the mysteries of spiritual existence. Contemporary humanity is used to looking at the environment in a purely material way, and therefore forms ideas from this purely material view. Thus it is difficult, above all, for us to penetrate the spiritual world, even with our imagination. Many believe that an understanding of the spiritual world cannot be gained if one cannot see into it. They believe this only because they have made their thoughts inflexible and desolate as a result of becoming too accustomed to thinking only of the physical world. After having started by saying all of this, I would like to speak to you today about some points that have to do with the life of the so-called dead. If we want to understand life between death and rebirth, we must start by considering the way in which a person is composed of the four aspects that we already know well, the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and the capital I. If we first examine the outermost fact of death, that is visible from the physical plane, we can say that one lays aside the physical body. We need not go into the different ways in which the physical body returns to the earthly elements, whether through cremation or decomposition. These are different essentially only in terms of the time each takes. But if, when we consider the fact that in death one's physical body falls away from one's entire being and becomes one with the earth, we examine this fact only in terms of its significance for the physical plane, we have actually considered death only in a very incomplete way. Spiritual movements that see only to a certain degree into spiritual realms often consider this in a very imperfect way. They allow themselves to be misled by all sorts of moral beliefs, which are actually in many ways unsuited to understanding correctly how the spiritual works into the physical world. All physical events also have spiritual meanings. There is no physical event that does not also have a spiritual meaning. Thus, the physical event of the body's physical bodies falling away is, more or less, that its parts, its molecules, its atoms break apart and are consigned to the earth. Now, a great bias in today's materialistic worldview, which has long fundamentally ruled humanity, is that the human body, as we bear it from birth to death, or let us say from conception to death, decays into the smallest parts, into atoms. These atoms are then absorbed into the earth or the earthly realm, where they remain atoms, and then as atoms become other beings. One can easily arrive at this bias through today's materialistic point of view. But even this way of seeing the world is actually fundamentally nonsense in light of spiritual science, because there really are no atoms in the sense meant by chemists. The smallest parts of our body, regardless of the way in which we, as a body, are united with the earth, become in the end warmth. In one way or another, over a shorter or longer period of time, our whole physical organism basically becomes, in the end, warmth. That is why we speak of warmth in spiritual science as the fourth state of matter, while physics does not accept it as a fourth state of matter, but rather only as a characteristic of the body. This warmth is, in fact, what is actually consigned to the earth. It is shared with the earth. Thus, from our physical body, we give warmth to our earth. What humans leave behind of themselves is really intimately connected with the warmth found in the earth. Human beings do not become air or water or something else. Those are only transitional states that they go through. The part of them that becomes air and water, in the end, becomes warmth. Yes, even if it takes centuries, the last remains of matter become warmth. And even if the skeletal system becomes warmth, perhaps only after millennia, nevertheless, it does become warmth in the end. If you see in a museum the ancient skeletons of people who walked the earth in ages long past, the time will come when these two will remain only as warmth within the earth body. The fact that the physical body remains with the earth at all has a great, a significant meaning for those who have passed through the gate of death. The departing soul enters the spiritual world and bequeaths its physical body to the earth. This is an endeavor, an experience for the so-called dead. The soul undergoes this experience. My body has left me. We must try to experience what an experience like this would be. What is this experience? Now, you can form a concept of this from experiences on the physical plane. Such an experience might be, let's say, when you have some new experience that you haven't had before, and you learn from it. In this case, you have added something to your soul that it did not possess before, a new concept, a new understanding. But now, think of this expanded to a much greater scale. It is an immensely powerful experience for human beings that they lay aside the body and bequeath it to the planet they are leaving. This gives them the possibility, when they are between death and birth, of being able to see, to think, to understand. This is a great, powerful experience that is comparable to no other earthly experience. The value of an experience for us here is that we have something in our soul that remains as a result, a consequence of the experience. Thus we may raise the question, what remains as a result, as a consequence, of the experience of the departure of the physical body from our total being? Were we not to have the experience of consciously participating in the laying aside of our physical body, as we cross the threshold of death, we would never develop an I consciousness after death. I consciousness after death is stimulated by our experience of the departure of the physical body. It has great meaning for the dead. I see my physical body going away from me. I perceive the feeling growing within myself from this event that I am an I. We would also state this paradox in another way. If we could not experience our death from the other side, we would not be able to have I consciousness after death. Just as the human soul comes into being at birth or even at conception, and adapts gradually to using a physical body, and thus achieves I-consciousness within the body, so does the human being achieve I-consciousness after death, from the other side of existence, by experiencing the falling away of the physical body from our total being. Just think what this actually means. When we look at death from the physical side of existence, it appears to us to be the end of our existence. There appears to be nothing beyond it. But seen from the other side, death as such is the most splendid thing the human soul could ever face, because it means that human beings can experience the triumph of spiritual existence over bodily existence. We do not remember the experience of our birth here into physical life. But although we cannot witness our birth into physical life, if we become fully conscious after death, we will always have the event of our death immediately before us. The event of our death is not frightening in any way, but is rather the greatest, most splendid, most beautiful experience that our soul can have. Death then shows us continuously the great fact that our consciousness, our self-awareness in the spiritual world originates from death. That death is the stimulator of this self-awareness in the spiritual world. Now we must look at the second component of our human existence, the etheric body. We know from the basic presentations we have all participated in together in the course of our branch meetings that this etheric body remains with us for a comparatively short time after death, and that then it is laid aside. We know too that a certain significance lies in the fact that this etheric body, such as we had, remains united with us for some days after death. As long as we still have this etheric body with us after death, we can still think thoughts as one can think them on earth. Thus, we can view as a great tableau all of the thoughts that we have carried within us. It has often been described to you that after death we view the thoughts we experienced during life in a life tableau. In the days in which we still have our etheric body with us, we see our whole life as in a panorama before us, and we see all of it before us simultaneously. That is, we see everything at once. What we call memory here in the physical world arises in the etheric body, but is bound to the physical body. But we have discarded the physical body. We see our thoughts. We do not bring them up from the depths that are connected with the physical body, but we see them as in a panorama and look over the life that we have experienced. Then we lay aside the etheric body. But this etheric body, which is now laid aside, remains visible to us throughout our entire further life after death. It is outside of us, but remains visible. It unites with the whole universe, but we can see what happens to it. It remains visible to us. And this belongs to the mysteries of death, that as long as we bear the etheric body with us, we see in a panorama what we had within us as thoughts while we lived, and that we unite this with the world outside of ourselves. We see it interwoven in the world. After death, this etheric body belongs to the world, not to our own I. The experience is really that what had woven through and lived within us as our own etheric body during earthly life now becomes a part of the outer etheric world. The time then comes when, as you know, only the I and the astral body remain of what we carried with us on the physical plane, as well, of course, as the view of what we were. We experience ourselves in a much different way than here in the physical body. We have an elevated awareness established in us by death. We must never, however, give ourselves over to the idea that the life between death and rebirth is unconscious on the part of the soul. The consciousness bound to life after death is a stronger and more acute consciousness than the one here in the physical body. But the consciousness is formed in quite a different manner. Here, on earth, we can approach the dead in the way we are trying to imagine them by gathering everything that spiritual science offers in order to reshape the ideas that have been adapted to the purely physical objects and events here on the physical plane. In this way, we can understand that after death we live in the I and in the astral body. We have put aside the etheric body. It is now connected to objective existence. My dear friends, for those who enter into the spiritual world, it is a truly soul-shaking experience to visit, to accompany the departed, with whom one may come into contact, and to follow not only the individual life of the person between death and rebirth, but also to experience what the deceased sees. The part of the individual is seen in the form of the etheric body that has been interwoven with the world, a world that is now an outer world, an objective world, to the person. And one observes what the departed has actually given to the etheric world. And thus we may, in a certain respect, experience in two ways those who have departed. We can experience what they have given to the etheric world, and we can experience what resides in their consciousness after death. The first contact with what the departed has left to the etheric world is quite soul-shaking. This is what was woven into the etheric body during earthly life, but is now spread out for the departed as an objective outer world. It would be shattering if we were not able to establish a connection with those beings living on between death and rebirth, who carry the consciousness and self-awareness of the dead, but rather only with what they left behind. Even then, such an experience deeply affects the soul that actually has contact with the spiritual world. Above all, what is soul-shaking is the real living experience that such spirituality, the etheric spirituality, such as that just referred to, that is, the etheric spirituality left behind by the dead, is actually continually around us. Just as we live in the air that surrounds us everywhere, what the dead have left behind as their etheric world surrounds us. This spirituality that I am now speaking of exists in the world in which our physical bodies also exist. Just as air surrounds us, so does what the dead leave behind. We are separated from the spiritual world only by our state of consciousness. We are not separated by spatial relationships, but by our state of consciousness. Take, for example, a person who strives to practice soul exercises. I want to explicitly emphasize that such soul exercises must be done in absolute inner quiet. Those who become restless during these soul exercises do themselves harm. When soul exercises are done in the way I have spoken and written about them, and in the way we have discussed them before, so that they are truly soul exercises and not affected by the physical body, they will never harm the human being in any way. We will never achieve true spiritual knowledge if we do not remind ourselves of these things now and then. So, now imagine practicing the following exercise. You see colors with your eyes, red, blue, and so on. And now you shift to trying to experience the red, blue, green, and so on as something living in a certain respect. In doing this exercise, we gradually realize that as human beings in the physical world, especially in our present materialistic time, we are present in it in a very crude way. We do not respond to the finer, more subtle impressions we may experience. We experience these finer things when we pay attention to the soul impression that colors make on us, or that other sensory impressions make as well. Of course, we all know roughly that if we let a blue surface affect us, it affects us differently than a red surface. For those who can feel it without becoming nervous in the process, I emphasize this explicitly, a red surface is something that, in quotes, attacks, something that reaches out of its surface to affect us. Something always comes out toward us from red. Blue brings about the opposite feeling in us. It remains peacefully in its place. Nothing comes out at us from blue. On the contrary, we have the feeling that we can feel more finely into the colors, that we can penetrate the color blue with our soul forces, that we can enter into it. Green is effectively in a state of rhythmic equilibrium. That is why it is so beneficial as the earth's vegetative cover. Green affects us so that, in part, we penetrate it, and in turn, it comes back to us. When we see a field of green plants, we have the feeling that we are entering into something, and then it comes back out toward us, into and then back out. The refreshing feeling that we have from seeing a wide green field comes from this rhythmic, balanced movement. You can be sure of the fact that such a thing has been noticed before by human beings, that one can live with colors, so to speak. If you read the chapter in Goethe's title Theory of Color on the moral effects of color, although it is understood by few today, you will find there the corresponding feelings that one can have with all colors. In this way, one can live with colors, as well as with other sense impressions, but we will talk about colors here in order to give an example. One can live with colors in such a way that with blue, something arises from our soul like a strength that is equal to the longing that issues from our soul, and this is readily absorbed by the blue. With red, it is as if something is created that meets us, but it does not want to accept us, that wants to conquer us in a certain subtle way. When we feel colors in this way, we can have a sort of moral soul experience. Of course, not everyone can master such exercises in one incarnation. But I describe these exercises so that you can see how the different worlds are interrelated. If you were to practice such exercises, you would live much more purely in the world of colors. If you practiced such exercises for other sense impressions, you would live in the world of those other sensations more purely, and soon something else would also enter in. Suppose that one were to experience the blue firmament as being alive in this way. Then the blue would not just be overhead, and this is a very subjective blue at that, because in reality there is no vault there, but it would be like a benevolent inner hemispheric expanse that absorbs one's soul life everywhere. A hemispheric expanse that, behind its two-dimensional quality, can come to terms with soul experience. Such is the way it is for those who witness the world in the deeper sense. Jacob Boehme, for instance, did not say, quote, when humans see the blue firmament, close quote. Instead, he said, quote, when humans see the depths, close quote. Therein lies the whole act of witnessing blue, seeing the depths. But an accompanying phenomenon occurs when we become so at one with a life of colors that our soul aspect glimmers at once in their presence. The opportunity to make use of a very short period of time is kindled, a moment that cannot otherwise be used at all. When you come into contact with an external object in ordinary physical life, you see it in this way. You see a particular color. This is, in fact, where your impression begins. Then you can reflect, form an idea about the color. When you see the color, your witnessing of the object begins. But that is not the beginning of what takes place. Today, even the experimental psychologist knows that a certain amount of time passes between the effect on the eye, EYE, and the appearance of the idea of blue. That is, the blue color affects the eye first. We do not perceive it immediately. Rather, a certain amount of time passes, and only then do we become aware of it. You can read in commonly found books how experiments about this are carried out in laboratories today. Experimenters construct certain apparatuses and attempt to cause an impression for the, in quotes, guinea pigs, the subjects sitting there. The subjects must now indicate by means of another apparatus when they notice an impression, so that the experimenter can determine the short period of time, the instant that passes between the attack on our sense organs so to speak, and the moment we become aware. A certain period of time elapses. During this time period, we do not yet experience the blue color, if we are talking about a blue impression. But during this period of time, we do already experience the moral impression of the color. It already affects us. So, the way in which the soul pours forth into the blue, into which it is readily absorbed, is already within us. The soul aspect of a color, in fact, takes effect before we experience the color, although it remains in the unconscious. Humans do not perceive it. We do not notice what precedes the perception of color. We only begin to develop our consciousness when color appears. Just think of when one is forced to pay close attention in a certain way to this moral impression of the color, to this soul experience of the color. Then something special takes place. You must pay attention to this when you place color on a surface, that is, when you paint, when you use colors that must arise from within your thoughts. When you are involved in true painting, then you work from the soul impression of the colors. In this case, you do not proceed as an artist who is simply reproducing a model. Rather, you know that to evoke a specific soul impression, you must use red. So you use red. You put blue in another place because you want to evoke a different soul impression. This is how all the painting is carried out in our building in Dornach. There, what surrounds us as color has come completely from the soul aspects, which appear through the colors. In this case, it was necessary to create the building as a soul being in the highest way. Just as we encounter the construction of the world, so the building has grown as a construction out of a soul being. You would perceive what is manifested in the Dornach building if you could use that short period of time that passes between the instant in which the building affects the sense organs and the instant in which the impression becomes conscious. Those who took part in the construction had to create all the colors and forms in the building precisely from this short period of time. I have led you in a somewhat scientific way into something that may seem difficult to you, but such difficulties must be overcome. As things are today, it may well be that someone can be as if blessed in some way. We are always blessed in a certain way in that we are present in the world, and it is able to retain this moment. If we can become more aware as we are looking at something, we will at times have the impression that in fact an interaction has already taken place between ourselves and what we see. We will see something and think, "It seems to me that I have already seen it before." You may be very familiar with the experience of encountering a being or object and having the feeling that it is there not just in the moment when we become conscious of it, but that it had already approached us, it already had come close. We might say that one can at times notice something subtly approaching. But for everyday life, what takes place in this short instant lies completely beyond our consciousness, beyond the threshold. In the moment when we can become aware of what lies just outside our consciousness, in this moment, we make an important spiritual discovery. I want to illustrate this with a specific instance once again. A number of you may have already heard this. I have mentioned it here before. Last year, a young boy died near our building. He was crushed by a furniture truck. The etheric body of this child is united with the Dornach building. It forms the aura of the Dornach building and lives in its aura. When we set out to create something artistic here, forces come from this etheric body, which then naturally appear larger. One feels these forces within as one feels the building at a soul level. Why is this? It is because the etheric bodies of the dead are preserved in the world that the dead see. The world of which I have just spoken that always surrounds us, and which we do not perceive simply because it remains unnoticed before the impression comes to us. What the departed see of our world, what they look at, is contained in the etheric world surrounding us. And indeed, we too would always see it if we could cross this threshold even a little, and in a way see just beyond the threshold before we look into the physical world. But our not seeing does not prevent the dead from being effective continually in this world through what they have left behind. A world surrounds us in which the etheric bodies of the dead live. They are connected to it in some way. But we do not perceive in our world the powerful interwoven state of what remains etherically present from the dead. Although what remains in the ether has an effect on our physical body and sets the instrument of the physical body in motion. However, we must adopt the feeling that our world must be expanded in order to take in what is present in the entire etheric world through the etheric bodies of the dead. First of all, the dead are not present in this world, but only their etheric bodies, which were left behind. The dead live on further in the astral body and the eye after they have put aside the etheric body. But the dead themselves are not so easy to find. You can comprehend from this how we must reform our ideas if you consider that everything pertaining to thought is separated from us along with the etheric body, which passes over into the outer etheric world. Thoughts that we have accumulated here in our physical body do not remain within us after death. Thought becomes the outer world. We do not behold our thoughts after death the way we did during life, when we could recall them from memory out of our subconscious. After death, we look upon our thoughts as if we were seeing an etheric painting. We see our thoughts outside in the world. Thoughts are something external for us when we have passed across the threshold of death. Whereas what reveals itself to us on earth through feeling and willing remains after death connected with our individuality. It lives on in the astral body and the eye. In beholding the moment of death, the eye awakens into self-awareness. The astral body awakens in such a way that the thoughts before us in the etheric painting penetrate into our astral body. Thus we experience them in our astral body. Here in the physical body, we experience thoughts by bringing them out from within. After death, we experience thoughts by looking on them as on stars, worlds, or mountains, and they make an impression on us. We receive this impression and experience it in our astral body and in our eye. That is, it is exactly opposite from the way it is in physical life. While we were here, we refer to thoughts as something internal, but we must refer to them as something external after death. Then we live merged with the world, poured out into the world. It is important that we see this, that we do not surrender to the idea that the world after death is only something like a fine, thin repetition of the physical world here, as is often assumed in spiritist circles. It is something quite different. It is something quite different because our thoughts are beings outside of our own being. Precisely when we bring such ideas before our soul, we realize that we not only need a bit of impartiality in order to declare ourselves in agreement with spiritual science, but also that we must be able to make our concepts fluid, to change our concepts somewhat, that we cannot claim we can imagine what is in the spiritual world with the concepts we have here in the physical world. Thus it is necessary for those who are in the position, let us say, to visit the so-called dead, to learn how to communicate with them. When we encounter an individual here in this world, we come into relationship with that person's inner self through words, facial expressions, and gestures. The departed, when we come into relationship with them, show us in the objective world what they want to express. They show us in imaginations what they experience, what they have to say to us. When one asks the dead something, they say, quote, "Look there. There you will find what I am now experiencing," close quote. But all this is a quick process. The dead have the ability to perceive thoughts suprasensibly because they are outside of things. We cannot see thoughts because we experience them inwardly. Our thoughts are within us. Only when we acquire the ability to behold thoughts suprasensibly as the dead do, can we experience along with them. Through this, the so-called dead have the highly unique ability to experience our thoughts. There is one circumstance in particular where this occurs, which I would like to touch on here. When someone whom we have loved has left us, we carry on the thoughts of the person in our soul. We think of the things we experienced together, what we felt together, and so on. I have said that the dead see thoughts. They can very quickly distinguish between the thoughts that they themselves have as impressions of the spiritual world, which signify imaginations of what is in the spiritual world, and the thoughts that incarnated people have in their souls. The departed can make that differentiation. They make the distinction through their inner experience. It is actually quite a big difference. If the dead are to experience thoughts about something that is only in the spiritual world, they must actively experience these thoughts. It is exactly the same with initiates. They must follow each part of the thought they experience themselves. It is indeed difficult to make the process clear. Suppose a painting were before you, but you could see this painting only if you sketched and traced each detail yourself. The dead can do this. They trace every thought they see, recreate the thought, so to speak, and experience this recreation. This recreation of what is present in thought formation in the spiritual world fundamentally represents a significant part of the life between death and rebirth. We recreate it thus. And then we know that we are dealing with thought formations that belong only to the spiritual world. The experience is different when one looks from within the spiritual world at thoughts that live in human beings in the physical world. There it is not as if one recreates them. Rather, the thoughts really confront one in such a way that one can behave passively in relation to them. Just as a plant need not be sketched first, but actually immediately forms an impression in us, so are the thoughts of the living. They really come about in a way similar to the way impressions of the physical world do here. And that is what uplifts, delights, warms the dead about the thoughts of the living whom they loved. It is a very special realm for the dead, looking into the thoughts of those who love them and stayed behind. It is a special world for them. If one could experience the world here only as what comes into being physically in the mineral, plant, animal, and human kingdoms, then there would be no art. Art is created in addition to, beyond what we actually need physically. Those who understand at all the evolution of humanity as being spiritual know that art cannot be absent from the world, in spite of the fact that even if there were no art, nature would be just as complete as it is now. If necessary, the dead would have to live in the way that incarnated human beings would live in a world of nature, bleak, dead, and bare without art. The dead would have to live in this way if they were forgotten immediately after their death by their loved ones. What is seen in the thoughts left behind in the souls of those who love the dead is certainly added to the world that the dead need directly. But it also elevates, improves the existence of the dead. We can compare this, in a sense, to art in the physical world. But these thoughts are uplifting, an improvement in a far superior way for the dead than the improvement in the physical world for us through art. Thus it is deeply significant for the whole world when we unite our thoughts with those of the dead, specifically in the way we have often spoken of here, when we bring to the dead the kinds of thoughts that are formulated in the conceptual language common to the living and the dead, in the language we speak here in spiritual science. The dead can understand the content of spiritual science just as well as the living can. It never becomes foreign to them. I believe we gradually form a vivid picture of the spiritual world precisely by gathering such concepts. We can find our way into what lies beyond the threshold through these concepts, and basically all that is available to us on this side of the threshold. In relation to these phenomena, we must consider that humanity today is short-sighted when it comes to looking at the world, although this is somewhat justified because it belongs to the world plane. But actually, humanity is more short-sighted than it should be. When modern people who are quite materialistically minded form their ideas about the world, they think that these ideas, these notions, are universally human. Indeed, you know how difficult it is to teach a materialistically minded person that it is possible to think differently. Materialists are firmly rooted in the physical world when they say that those who do not think as they do are fools. There is no greater inner intolerance than that of materialistically minded people. Such people basically always think that in earlier times people believed that all kinds of spiritual beings were present, that they did hardly anything in life without conjecturing or even seeing spirits everywhere. But the materialist claims that all that was meaningless fantasy, and that finally humanity has come far enough to have abandoned this childishness. And yet it is possible for people to notice at every turn how nonsensical such an idea actually is. I want to explain this to you with an example that seems far afield and comes from a much different side than what we have discussed today. Let us think of the image, which we have often examined from different perspectives, of the first stage of the earth, of the paradise existence of human beings, as it is described in the Bible. Let us think of an image of the first humans, Adam and Eve, in paradise. Eve taking a bite of the apple, giving the apple to Adam, the serpent in the tree seducing Eve. Indeed, this motif has been painted from time to time, and even in the present, with a woman portrayed as realistically, as naturalistically as possible, and also a realistic man, because it is modern. Whether impressionistic or expressionistic, either way, a woman as realistic as possible, and an even more realistic man, and a naturalistic landscape, and a naturalistic serpent, bearing its naturalistic voracious teeth, and so on, are represented. But it was not always painted this way, because such an image would not show the actual facts that can be seen within it. Of course, we know that the symbol of the ultimate seducer, of Lucifer, can be seen in the serpent. However, Lucifer is a being that, as we know, stayed behind at the old moon stage, a being that can have the serpent as its symbol only as it appears on earth. The serpent itself is not Lucifer. Rather, the serpent must, somehow, be seen in a spiritual way. That is, this Lucifer must also be seen with soul powers. With our inner effort, Lucifer must be seen from the inside outward. So how could one see him, my dear friends? We all basically carry the impressions of Lucifer in us, just as we do the impressions of Ahriman. Without any demonstration or detailed explanations, which you can search for yourselves on the basis of what we already have in our literature, I want to show you how one could imagine Lucifer. Human beings carry impulses of the Lucifer aspect in themselves. We carry them in such a way that they sit in our head. They penetrate from our head into the astral body, the stage at which Lucifer remained behind. Thus, whereas the spirits of form have shaped the head, the luciferic impulses penetrate into the head and also into what is shaped by the astral aspect, the spinal cord. So if we drew the head and its extension, the spine, separate from the human body, we would have a serpent, a snake-like creation with a human head. Of course, the whole thing must be thought of astrally, with the head somewhat reproducing the human head and the spine, which is attached to it, snaking down. Think of this objectively projected outward. It is a serpent with a human head. That is, seeing Lucifer externally in an image, one could actually say a serpent with a human head. That is, seeing Lucifer externally in an image, one could actually say a serpent with a human head. Not a serpent with a serpent head, that is not Lucifer, but an earthly serpent, which the form, spirits of form have already shaped into an earthly form. So, we would have to say a serpent with a human head. This means that the artist who wanted to paint Lucifer in a tree would have to depict a serpent with a human head winding around the tree. Thus the artist would paint from the perception of spiritual science. We would thus have to imagine Adam and Eve near the tree and curled in the tree, similar to the body of a serpent, the now astral spinal cord with something resembling the human head. When the woman first sees it, of course, it resembles the female face. Go to the museum here, to the art gallery, and look at the painting by Meister Bertram, and see how he painted, in the middle of the Middle Ages, this serpent on the tree as I have just described it. It is striking. It is superbly striking, because it is proof that a painter in the Middle Ages painted from the real, actual imaginations of the spiritual world. This is fully valid proof that we do not have to go back so many centuries in order to obtain evidence, even now, that people already knew something in those days that people today in this materialistic age have forgotten. Of course, the subject that I have just explained is never touched on in conventional art history. Nevertheless, everyone in this materialistic time could be convinced, not just in attitude, but also in their way of thinking, that we ceased looking at the spiritual only a few centuries ago. Whoever goes to the art gallery and looks at this painting of paradise by Meister Bertram has fully valid proof, brought to the outer physical plane, that it really has not been so long ago that people could see into the spiritual world with atavistic clairvoyance and knew its secrets in a much different way than we know them in the present. Just think how blindly people move through the world today. If only they wanted to, they could see for themselves externally on the physical plane that evolution is present in humanity. This is what is important. In the course of the last 3 to 4 centuries, the old unconscious, more atavistic clairvoyance has retreated. Of course, Meister Bertram could not have developed spiritual science. He simply looked into the etheric realm to see Lucifer, and then he painted it. This was unconscious, instinctive clairvoyance. In order for our outer sight to come about, this old beholding of the spiritual world had to recede, but we must regain it, and the time must gradually come when what has been lost is regained, but in the area of consciousness. Therefore, this must be prepared through spiritual science. Humanity will approach the spiritual world only by studying spiritual science. But this spiritual science must truly give insight into the spiritual world. Today, we can scientifically prove how much the natural sciences can achieve. When purely spiritual thinkers speak about consciousness, they are actually speaking of the soul implement, the bodily instrument of the soul life. Today one can test what the descriptions originating from the most important scientific minds of the present say about the soul aspect. In their words, the soul organization is called psychophysiology. There you will find that these people always examine, in a highly peculiar manner, the sensory life and the imaginational life, The soul instrument belongs to these, and they describe what is happening in the brain and in the nervous system when a person senses or imagines. In their view, a parallel process turns up everywhere in the physical body. If these researchers would go on to examine feeling and willing, they would find no bodily parallel processes. The fact that something like this does not actually emerge, is not noticed, is simply because the natural sciences and their rear guard, the monists, simply boast about the fact that for every thought and sensory process, a certain physical process is present, and that thinking and perception are bound to the brain. Perhaps one cannot really say rear guard, because a rear guard is valuable, but the monistic rear guard of the natural sciences is highly superfluous. They do not speak of feeling or willing. At the most, they speak of, in quotes, shades of feeling, that is, a certain nuanced visualization. But they do not come to feeling and will. The honest scientists say that science does not extend to feeling and will. You can read what I am now talking about in any scientific literature. It is proven everywhere. For instance, you can most easily find what I am now saying proven in the work of Dr. Theodor Ziehen, a very well-known psychiatrist and psychophysiologist of our time. He shows the individual processes that correspond to thinking and perception. He gets to shades of feeling, but not to actual feeling and will. He thus denies feeling and will. He says that they simply do not exist. One could not scientifically prove more clearly that scientific thinking extends only over the temporal, extends only over what we cast off with death. What goes beyond, what lives precisely in feeling and will, as I have mentioned, belongs so minimally to the body that scientists cannot even find it, and they even dismiss, deny it. Such people boast that there is no feeling or will because these cannot be found with normal science. Science itself proves to us today that feeling and will are not connected to the body, as such in the way that thoughts and perceptions are. This distinction has to do with the fact that our thoughts will separate themselves from us and appear dispersed outside of us after death. Feeling and will remain with us, and from feeling and will spring the strength to create the thought tableau. Those who wish to can show strictly through science that feeling and will have nothing to do with what nature is. Rather, they go forth after death as the astral body and the I. Feeling and will remain with the human individuality. They awaken into a new consciousness in the way I have described. Because the entire act of spreading out is etheric, it is reflected in the astral body and then in the eye, when the astral body too is laid aside. Everything is basically in order because modern science does not refute spiritual science, but rather confirms it. If people could only muster some understanding, they would see precisely how natural science, through real understanding, proves the legitimacy of spiritual science, including its specific assertions. Spiritual science is, as you see, something that must begin entering into the evolution of humanity in our time, must begin to take hold of humanity, or else humanity will come to grasp only the temporal and will know nothing of the eternal that lives in us. The time will come when human beings will realize this, and then we'll become more engaged in the evolution of the life of the will, in the evolution of the feeling life. Because only through feeling and will do we unite ourselves with the world, which is not void of thoughts. Of course, people will argue we just feel the spiritual world, we do not will it. But indeed, we are united, precisely through feeling and will, with the objective world of thought, with thoughts that really live, not with thoughts that we merely think. And just as humanity could see into the spiritual world in antiquity, so must humanity regain this view into the spiritual world in the future. We will be able to achieve this, however, only if we first decide to engage with the thoughts in the spiritual world, which in our time are dismissed. For us to engage with the thoughts of the spiritual world, there is much that must be corrected in the concepts and ideas that are swirling around us in the present. It is hard to believe how basically unthinkingly people in our time think, permit me to use this paradox. They give definitions which they are adamantly convinced are correct and cannot be disputed at all. But more than ever, spiritual scientists have the task of testing those ideas of which people are adamantly convinced, because they seem completely logical, and people are convinced of them. If, for instance, someone in today's materialistic age is asked, "What is a true concept?" that person would give a reply like, quote, "A true concept is an inner picture of an object that is actually present outside in the world," close quote. That is, everyone today would define a concept as a truth consisting in the correlation of an outer manifestation with an image that one makes in one's thoughts. Now, if we investigate the concept, we can very easily prove that the true concept has absolutely nothing to do with what is usually called a concept. We can easily prove that the object travels very different paths than does the image that a person makes as a concept. If a concept is true only when it correlates to an object, then it would, of course, be true only as long as the manifested object confirmed it. Thus, we could compare a concept to, for example, a painting made as a portrait of a person. The portrait is good if it resembles the person, but it has nothing to do with the person's inner being. The correlation of the picture with a self does not come near to the inner truth of the picture. Imagine that you paint a portrait of a person, and then the person dies right afterward. The picture corresponded at first to that which is, and afterward to that which is not. The being has absolutely no relation to whether the picture is true or not, no relationship with the outer manifestation. For those who look at the subject in a really logical way, the relationship is completely contrived. The essential thing is to experience things inwardly. Humanity must learn to experience inwardly again. But above all, humanity must achieve a sense for real truth again, and we can be led to this in particular through our time, which is so difficult and full of suffering. Little by little, through materialism, we have basically deviated from the truth completely. We have lost ourselves through materialism, precisely in relation to the sense for truth. Compare something you can verify today. Compare the journalistic description — many people today read nothing other than newspapers — of some event that you witnessed yourself with your own senses. If you read about it in the newspaper, you will find that it is depicted in a way that the journalist thinks will make an impression on readers. But the feeling that everything should correspond to the truth, this is diminishing more and more. That is only a part of it. And as long as a feeling for truth does not permeate humanity, the impulse that leads out of the sensory world to the spiritual world will not be able to arise in our souls, because in the absence of these concepts that correspond to truth, the concepts secretly become false. For example, how often have we experienced the following? Someone writes about spiritual science, let us say, about what I have published on spiritual science. He writes, and of course cannot help saying, based on his materialistic concepts, that it has all been invented from fantasy, and that inventing from fantasy is not allowed. And then he decides to investigate how someone could come to be such a fantasizer. Such an article was really published not long ago. It investigates how a person could be so fanciful. It explains where that person comes from — in this case it was myself — where he lived earlier, and how he could have such fantasies based on a certain miscegenation. The author dreams up the most unbelievable things with his materialism. And that is what I am saying. One simply takes the lie into one's own hands. One twists the truth inwardly. Of course, this cannot be directly proven. But what dishonesty lies therein, when one is able to accuse someone of fantasy and then to dream up things about him? If you look more closely at life today, you will see how tremendously prevalent is this lack of a feeling of responsibility, this lack of concern that everything we say be consistent with reality. Without acquiring this sense in the most intensive way, we cannot find the entrance to the spiritual world. We simply will not be able to comprehend why something must be true that spiritual science elicits from the spiritual world as truth. But we are much too closed-minded to really contemplate the present day in this way. And we are too attached to our interests to really look at all areas to see how untruth pierces through and fragments every one of life's circumstances. To contemplate true perception, true visualization, is one of the first preparations for spiritual science. And such reflecting must become a conscious preparation time for what the future of humanity must really be. Because the future salvation of humanity can come about only by reuniting our souls with the spiritual. Spiritual science is not something that we seek like other sensation. Rather, spiritual science must be something that we know must arise in the present time because humanity needs it. And if we look at the course of the evolution of humanity in an unobstructed and lucid way, we must, to a certain extent, feel an obligation to it. What boundless enrichment we experience through what spiritual science can give us. The world is expanded little by little because to the physical truth of the evolution of humanity is added spiritual truth. In this materialistic age, we are cut off more and more from the world in which human beings exist between death and rebirth. Through spiritual science, we must again live together with the whole human being, even when the human being doesn't have a physical body. Our materialistic world offers us nothing of this. Precisely in our difficult times, it can really be a blow to the soul to see something like the book, for example, that has just been published by Ernst Haeckel. He calls this book Ewigkeitsgedanken, Thoughts on Eternity. Now, Ernst Haeckel is one of the most outstanding minds of our time. These thoughts on eternity tie directly in with the great war of the present. What is its essence? The main content of this newest book from Haeckel is his question, what can this war show us? Needlessly, thousands upon thousands of people are dying violently in it. Can we not see in this war the proof, says Haeckel, that all thoughts on eternity and infinity are absurd? Should not this war convince us that human life perishes through external coincidence, by bullets and so on? Should this war not show us, according to Ernst Haeckel, that there is nothing beyond ordinary physical life? Of course, there are also other people today who come to thoughts of a very different kind about eternity through these difficult events, to thoughts on eternity that at least evoke the feeling that those who pass through the gate of death in such times continue to carry on their tasks for humanity in other worlds, that what they have sacrificed is in fact the starting point for what they must achieve without a physical body. With current science, one can prove this and that. Just as we can make excellent machines that help human culture progress in a peaceful way, and also the most terrible machines of destruction, the very same science can create this and that and prove this and that. In order to really penetrate the world in which the eternal lives, spiritual science is essential. Spiritual science shows us, among other things, I have already spoken of this before, at least to a number of you here, that those who leave the physical body early, before the usual age for the physical plane has run its course, who give their etheric bodies to the etheric world, live on in their individuality. Spiritual science also shows that such an etheric body, which could have continued to support the physical body for decades when it was present, when it was consigned to the etheric world, still has life forces, and it is present in the etheric world, as I have shown you through examples. What the departed gain with their sacrificial deaths lives on in their individualities. It lives on precisely in such a time as ours, when we can grasp the true meaning of what is happening with the soul eye of spiritual science, SOUL-EYE, soul eye of spiritual science. Spiritual science makes us aware of the spiritual counter-image of what is now taking place on European soil as the violent and traumatic events play out on the physical plane. The spiritual correlate, the parallel spiritual process, must flow into the future, into the physical events of the evolution of humanity, because all that is physical is guided from the spiritual world. But this will become fruitful only if human souls incarnated on earth are conscious of receiving something beneficial from what lives on in the spiritual world that the dead have brought about through their sacrificial deaths. This effective and useful gift lives on in the spiritual world and helps us to work into the future on earth when we unite with the dead through our consciousness of the reality of the spiritual world. That is what spiritual science must give to human beings, including for this situation. Then they will be able to make the spiritual aspect of this most violent world event fruitful in the correct sense for the future, and to conceive and sense and perceive in the right way. From the combatant's courage, from the blood of battle, from the suffering of those abandoned, from the people's sacrificial death, spiritual fruit will grow. May souls guide their senses, conscious of spirit, into the realm of the spirits. The end of Lecture 1.